Hello and welcome to another edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined remotely yet again by my co-host and Oscar pull winner by the slimmest of margins, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Hey there, Charlie.
I did. I think I really did win. I got 17 points out of a possible 24.
Barely. I got 16.
I just wanted them to remind our listeners, if you listened to our show and you took heed, you would have won. You don't lose with 17 or even 16 points. Brett, I know you won. You got 13 points, but who are you listening to? I got 17, Hannah got 16, and you got 13. What are you going with? You're going with your own advice? You're going with your own gut hunt? Brett, don't do that, buddy. You know better than that, man.
Hey, don't go disparaging our listeners who might share their prize winnings with us when he does get his gift.
I'm on Brett's side. You could have done better.
Hey, but since you got one more right than I did, I did lose what we normally would call the wine wager, because we said whoever ended up winning among the two of us, the other one had to get the winner a bottle of wine. I ended up with a slightly different libation choice, which I dropped off at your home this afternoon, and I believe you have not yet revealed to yourself. But there is a reason for it, so I think you should do the big reveal now.
Yeah, I got home from work, and Kate said, "Hannah, drop by," and she brought something off. You're not allowed to look, so I didn't look. Whoa, it's got a funky bottle, dude. It's double handles. I see what you did there. Whoa, this is not a wine wager. This is the Kraken Black Spiced Rum. Good Lord, Hannah.
But what's on the label, Charlie?
I see what you did. I'm going to say it's a Kraken, Hannah. It's a Kraken. But I guess that would be the big cousin of a squid / octopus. And the reason you did that is because you're referencing my octopus teacher, which is what put me over the top, which is the best documentary feature, which is why I won the pool, because you picked something else for that category. You didn't trust in the octopus teacher, Hannah. You didn't trust.
And I didn't. But there were other ones, though, that was a surprise. But yeah, the Kraken is your little gift. Although since you are now fully vaccinated and I am fully vaccinated, we are getting inching closer to when we may actually be able to do this podcast in the same location again and to see a film together again.
Should, Are you actually going to drink this with me?
I am going to come over there and have like a rum and coke or something with the Kraken. But yes, I looked all over for something that looked like it had an octopus on the label. And so there you go. Mm. But other than my octopus teacher winning best documentary, which I didn't have any real issue with that winning. I think it was sort of benefiting from late word of mouth. A lot of people are just catching it on Netflix, so I wasn't completely surprised. And that was sort of one of those nice little wins that every once in a while those come around. What was not a nice little win and what did not help the show at all was the Best Actor Award that was the final award announced for the night that went to Anthony Hopkins for playing dementia so brilliantly in The Father. And to me, that choice over the late Chadwick Boseman or even over Riz Ahmed for Sound of Metal, to me, was just such an anticlimactic end to the Oscar telecast, which I think was not that great to begin with.
I disagree. It ended on a thud. But because Steven Soderbergh, who put it together, you know, he had that awesome opening with Regina Hall walking like she belonged in an Ocean's movie, and it was moving and it was clicking, and he did the best he could. You know, people separated people in Europe. I liked the set. I didn't mind that they were in an active train station. The tiered levels worked for me. They didn't cut anybody's acceptance speech off. He took a chance. He shot for the moon. Best Picture was third to last, and he set it up that way because he was guessing, along with the rest of us, that Chadwick Boseman would win. And if you end the night with Chadwick Boseman's widow on stage extolling his virtue and everybody getting teary-eyed, he would have won. Soderbergh would be a genius right now, and we would be talking about the genius of Soderbergh. But the Oscar voters, not, and they're not wrong, Anthony Hopkins' performance was sublime. It was superlative. It was a wonderful performance and a wonderful film. I don't feel bad that he won. And he offered, say, hey, I'm old. I will give a thank you speech over Zoom. And they declined. They said, no Zoom. They declined. He offered. But, you know, he's old. He's not going to stay up London time that late for the award. So it's, you know, Soderbergh shot for the moon. He tried. And the worst happened. It ended with the biggest thud ever. Questlove tried to save it. Excellent DJing all night, but he just couldn't save it.
Well, but also what I did not like was that the songs, the best song nominations, were relegated to the pre-show. So good. If you want it, no. So that good. To me helps break things up. This was a boring 3 hours. So it started with such promise. I loved Regina King's swagger walk up. That was tracking shot. That was awesome. I liked the setting. I had really high hopes, but without a host for 3 hours, it just got more and more boring to me as it went along. And then when they announced the best picture, third from last, I was completely thrown off, and it just ruined the momentum of anything that that it could and should have had. And to be expected to watch the pre-show in like 5 hours total in order to get your best song nominations to actually hear them, I just think that was a big mistake. And so, you know, I look forward to next year to just see how things shake out. We've also got a lot of big musical movies coming out next year. And so I think they're going to reimagine a little bit. They're going to have a West Side Story, something live from that next year, and from In the Heights. So I'm hoping to catch up on everything I missed in terms of music as part of the program that maybe next year.
The majority of song performances, like 3 out of 5 of them, usually there's clunkers and they fall flat. And if there was momentum, they just annihilate it. And sometimes they even truncate the song. Like you can only play 90 seconds of it, and they're never connecting with the audience. And they're certainly not connecting with the audience at home. But I don't miss those. But what I did miss was they didn't do clips. They didn't do clips for the nominated films, like best visual effects. I didn't get to see the visual effects. I just got people to talk about, you know, they had little anecdotes about this guy used to work as a dishwasher. Nobody cares. I want to see the clips of the actors. I want to see clips of the best costumes and the best makeup and da-da-da-da-da. Give me clips. Give me factoids.
That's why it just didn't work. It couldn't sustain for 3 hours under those conditions. And but all in all, we did pretty good. I think, you know, there were always just a few. I should have known better. One of the only ones we missed was the Colette winning for Best Documentary Short.
No, that was the second biggest shock on that. There's no guessing Colette.
It was not the best filmmaking of the bunch at all. But you know, you should always go with the Holocaust-related film that that celebrates a 90-year-old survivor. We just should have known.
No, you got to go with a close Hollywood connection. I feel there's no way. Like, Colette was a huge surprise. Nobody was talking about that little film. Nobody. Yeah,
no, that's true. But the hashtag Oscars so old, I was seeing that float around between Colette and between Anthony Hopkins. Oscars so old sort of resonated at the end with me. So we'll see. But I hope to reclaim victory next year. And you're the one who's going to have to pony up the libations.
I don't plan on losing again there, Hannah. Well, not again. I just don't lose. So I don't plan on losing.
We'll see about that. Anyway, let's move on perhaps to something that's actually new in theaters.
Fair enough.
What do you think?
The biggest film this week. I think it's actually in limited theaters, but why go to the theaters when you can turn on your Amazon Prime Video and watch this full title, by the way, which they shoehorned in, Tom Clancy's Without Remorse. It's not just Without Remorse. It's Tom Clancy's Without Remorse. Hannah, I'm pretty sure you're a huge Tom Clancy fan and read all of his novels. Am I right?
Read? Oh, are they books?
They made a book out of that? I'm in high school. I read a lot of Tom Clancy. Hunt for Red October, Red Storm Rising, Cardinal the Crim, the whole thing. I read this book. It was published in 1993. And there's no, and you know, Tom Clancy is J.K. Rowling for white males over 50. They love Jack Ryan. And a lot of them say Without Remorse is their favorite book. It combines a vigilante hero killing Baltimore pimps, who also goes back to Nam to save American POWs from the Soviets. It's got everything a certain demographic wants. And this is nothing like the book. Nothing. So if you've read the book or even haven't read the book and you're like, you're looking forward to the film adaptation of the book, not the book. Not the book. Watch the trailer first, folks. It's not the book. This is Michael B. Jordan playing John Kelly. And John Kelly, they've moved him forward. He's not in Nam. He's in Syria. Syria is far more recent. He needs to save a hostage, goes in, and he's not being held by Syrians. He's being held by Russians. And a lot of Russians end up dead. If John Kelly's around, people are going to end up dead. He's also not killing Baltimore pimps, which is a shame. I'm sure that's awesome. He's still a Navy SEAL, and that's the only comparison. There's a guy named John Kelly. He is slash was a Navy SEAL. The Russians want revenge. They don't kill him. They kill his 7-month pregnant wife, Hannah. Talk about the ultimate motivation. You want to get John Kelly in your grill? He becomes John Wick then. He's not just going to kill the goons who broke in his house. He's going to the top. He's going all the way to the top. And he doesn't care. You know, he'll go outside Dulles. We know where that is. And he doesn't care if you have diplomatic immunity. He doesn't care if he's in the federal pokey. He's going to kill you. And he's going to get a name before he kills you. So I love the book, but I love this reboot, this refresh, this John Kelly of played by Michael B. Jordan. I was all over it. If you're the fan of Jack Ryan, Alec Baldwin, Harrison Ford, even Ben Affleck, you know, or even that weird 2014 reboot with Chris Pine, Jack Ryan, colon, Shadow Recruit. You know, this is a lot more blood splatter than you are used to. It's less spy and more, you know, almost John Wick. Not quite John Wick. Thumbs up for me. I like what they're doing. It's fresh. It's new. Jodie Turner-Smith shows up as the SEAL commander. Hello. There's never been a female SEAL, by the way, but I'm all aboard. Hannah, are you on board?
I'm on board for as much of it as I've actually seen. I made the mistake of trying to watch the screener on my iPad while I was on a little mini vacation. And I did not realize that if you fall asleep and the movie keeps playing, you're out of luck in terms of watching it again. And so I think I got about maybe halfway through it. And it was good. I didn't realize that there was this whole Jack Ryan universe where a supporting character from another book would get his own franchise here. I love Michael B. Jordan. I mean, he was great in Creed. Jodie Turner Smith from Queen and Slim. That's the first that I really got to see her. And so I will go back. I have Amazon Prime. I will watch it this weekend and finish to see exactly where this thriller goes. I don't think it's not nearly as much in my wheelhouse as it is yours. I haven't read the Tom Clancy novels.
Don't need to.
But I think it looks very, it's intriguing in that Tom Clancy conspiracy thriller sort of way. I think it's like a decent post-Oscar film. You know, one of those ones that won't be remembered all that much in a few months, but for now, when we're used to seeing at this point sometimes some really weak things, this one holds its own.
Yeah, it is not top shelf. You know, it's not John Wick. It's, you know, but it is passable. Like if you're tired of these Oscar bait films and you tried Nomadland and you tried The Father, but it didn't have enough blood, then Without Remorse is probably in your wheelhouse and it's going to satiate you for the next couple weeks until the next one comes out. Directed by Stefano Sollima. We know him. He directed Sicario 2, Sicario : Day of the Soldado. So he can, you know, he knows how to ratchet up suspense and show heads exploding. You know, he gets to do a plane crash here. There's a very interesting plane crash where it splits into him and got underwater theatrics. He gets to play around. He's got a budget to do it with. But, you know, what would you call it? Admit it. It's not the Kraken. It's, but it's not Bud Light. It's Heineken.
It's somewhere in the middle. Well, and Taylor Sheridan, who wrote it, he did Wind River, Hell or High Water. Those were films that I actually also did really like. So I think
I hope you liked Hell or High Water. I think it was your favorite film.
I loved Hell or High Water, but I liked Wind River too. You know, that was one that was.
I'm surprised he wrote this. It doesn't feel like him. It's not in. No. You know, because it's not top shelf, and he is like the best screenwriter in Hollywood. He's got an Oscar under his belt to prove it. He's amazing. This has been in development hell forever. Keanu was supposed to do it. Tom Cruise was supposed to do it. And, you know, and they find, you know, this has been in development for like 20 years, Hannah. And so I'm shocked that Taylor Sheridan adapted this book, even though he didn't adapt it. Yeah. He just took the character and made it new.
Yeah, but if you had to pick between like Tom Clancy's Without Remorse, I still really am going to pitch Nobody that we saw a few weeks ago as sort of my, what I consider to be the more surprising, better overall experience.
Nobody is head and shoulders better than Tom Clancy's Without Remorse. If you can still get your hands on Nobody, do it. I can't believe you haven't seen that already. I'm talking to any listener out there. I can't believe you haven't seen this movie yet.
I don't know if anybody's seen Nobody. I'm having a hard time finding anybody who's seen Nobody, but they really should.
Somebody. And now for something completely different. Mila Kunis. She's a junkie. She in the film 4 Good Days, Mila Kunis plays Molly, and she is a junkie. She's just not a part-time user. She's, you know, 15, 20 years down the road, still doing it. You know, every fix is still going to be her last fix. She's still going to get her life together, but she's running out of time and teeth to get that done. But 4 Good Days is not from Molly's point of view. It's from her mother's, played by Glenn Close. Glenn Close, she's just like Molly. She says, this is the last time I will ever help you. This is the last time. Well, it never is the last time. She's a mother and she has a mother's love. So every time Molly comes crawling back on her front porch, this time, missing teeth. It's like she has no teeth. They all rotted out of her mouth due to, you know, meth and heroin, whatever else she injects in herself. And she pleads with her mother. Mom, this time, this is it. I have no high school diploma. I have no job skills. I do not have custody of my children. I have nothing. This is it. And they discover there's a shot. I did not know about this. There's a shot that you can give a heroin addict, which takes away the buzz. Takes away. But the problem is you have to be clean. You have to be like 1 week clean. And that's where the 4 Good Days comes in. She's been clean for 3 days. Molly needs 4 more days. Can she do it? To us, people who got a job and little league practice and kids and the Kraken and whatever, 4 days is nothing. 4 days go by in a blink. But Molly, 1 hour to Molly is torture. It's not looking good for her to make it 4 Good Days without drugs. So 4 Good Days to me, very scary. I don't know if it's a wake-up call. This is not the first nor last of a movie to try to scare us about opioids and the epidemic and what it does to families, but it's still, I don't know, it still feels somewhat fresh. Maybe it's because we've never seen someone like Mila Kunis go through it. What do you say, Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, I just felt like I'd seen it before. I'd seen this movie before. I'd seen these same themes before. Mila Kunis and Glenn Close, I mean, both deliver excellent performances, and it's not the kind of movie where you tune out. I mean, you're rooting for them and you're wondering where it's going to go and you're not 100% sure. But it made me, I just flash back to Beautiful Boy with Timothy Chalamet and Steve Carell, which is about 2 years ago now. And Ben is Back with Luke Hedges and Julia Roberts, essentially the exact same cycle of, you know, do we take him back? Do we trust? Can we believe this is it? A mother's love for a drug addicted child, even no matter what their age is. And so I just felt that that to me, there wasn't anything particularly fresh about it other than the fact that you just had good enough performances that that kind of made you stick with the film. You know, and we've seen it with, you know, just a family wanting to help, but getting burned out on trusting that their loved one is going to be able to this time really break the cycle. So it based on a true story, and those are always, I think that sometimes hinders where the film version can go. It's based on really what was a Washington Post reporter's article, Eli Saslow, about Amali and about, you know, mother fighting this battle. And so I just, you know, I appreciate, I read the actual original article, 2016 article called How's Amanda? And so you can sort of find that online and read the article, and you really get a really good overall view of what the story that this film is going to tell. But I do think that that in trying to stay as faithful to what the article was about, it just sort of lacked to me just that little extra something that could have just put it into that next level.
I also went back and I read the article, and it shocked me how close the screenplay is to what happened. I mean, the event, the house they go to, what happens at the end, certain situations in the house happened. He was really, the screenwriter was really true to life, following a real mother-daughter relationship as it expands and contracts regarding Molly's, or in real life, Amanda's habits. You know, the links that this girl goes to connive and lie and scheme to undercut what is best for her just to get a couple hours of peace is, you know, we call it insane. Like, how, you know, there's, she goes to a school and there's this girl like, I could never let this happen to myself. You know, what's wrong with you? Just stop. And how could you let this da 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 da? And it's like, I can see things from her point of view. Like, yeah, like, how could you imagine? But, you know, we don't know. We can't see through Molly's eyes. I cannot experience life through her eyes, but I can through her mother's. I've never experienced that. My sons are 8 and 1. They're not out there on the streets yet, but you can sort of imagine the mom knows it's in her best interest to give up. Her new husband's like, what are you doing here, man? But she's like, this is my daughter. I can't let go. I can't just kick her out to the wolves. I'm going, you know, there's nothing she can do. She's also a junkie in a way to helping her daughter. So it's not as rough as we're making it out to sound. It's actually not as rough as Ben's back. No. Ben's back is rough.
Ben's back was rougher.
This is a little less rough, but it's not unicorns and teddy bears either.
But it's also not Ben's back is to me the closest to what this is, and I think Ben is Back is better overall. I felt more invested in that
Ben
one.
Ben is Back takes a genre switch in the second half
a little, but so I think, you know, again, to see Mila Kunis in this kind of role, I think was good. Glenn Close, I mean, I never saw Hillbilly Elegy. I haven't gone back to see that, and that's what she was nominated for, I believe, at the Oscars this year. So apparently she plays also maybe the mother of an addict in that
she
one.
She plays the mother of Amy Adams, the addict. But it's not really, she's more of a grandma-grandson relationship, not so much mom-daughter in that movie.
But still very unusual that she would choose to take both those roles so close together, although she does have a relationship of sorts already with the director of this film who did Albert Nobbs, which
another
I
movie
didn't.
She was nominated for. I loved Albert Nobbs, and you know, and if they have a good relationship, Rodrigo Garcia, you know, if you have a good relationship with the director and he comes calling, you're probably going to do it. And this is actually, I think, filmed before Hillbilly Elegy. This got caught in like a COVID cycle or something and delayed.
Yeah, so I wasn't a huge fan of Albert Nobbs personally, so there might be that slight difference in how it's directed that it didn't appeal to me as much, but. But again, no harm, no foul, I would say, in watching it. And it's just another one of those there but for the grace of God kind of films where you just do feel a certain sympathy for both characters, I think, for the mother and the daughter.
Well, Glenn Close is now a Washington, D.C. beloved icon. After at the Oscars, she got up and did debut and shouted out D.C. go-go culture. Which, you know, they're going to paint a mural of her downtown somewhere on a brick wall.
Never heard of Debut personally, so
where
that was
you
all
been?
New to me.
Where, how do you how do I know this song and you don't know this song? All right.
I do not know.
By the way, before we launch into our final film, which is the documentary, remember we saw the Notorious B.I.G. documentary, and then the next week we saw City of Lies, which is Johnny Depp and Forest Whitaker and the whole thing. And I said, one day, Hannah, I'm going to make you listen to this album. Well, guess what's in the mail, Hannah? 1994. Notorious B.I.G.'s album Life After Death, 2 discs on vinyl in the mail. I'm going to make you sit right here on the couch and listen to that thing.
You better pour me a really, really tall glass of Kraken before I start drinking it. And,
it's going to happen.
And I'm there. It'll happen. Maybe we'll just blast the sound out to the balcony or something and listen that way. I'm very excited for you.
You should be. It's going to be really good. So we saw a documentary called Street Gang about the most violent street in America. Okay, no, it's not. Street Gang, colon, how we got to Sesame Street. This is the Sesame Street documentary of who had the idea, where did it come from, how did it get on TV, and its cultural impact. I've seen Sesame Street documentaries before. At a film festival in 2014, I saw I Am Big Bird, the Carol Spinney story. Carol Spinney, you know, did, he was inside Big Bird, and he also did the voice of Oscar the Grouch. But there, and I thought I knew about Sesame Street, and there's a lot I did know. But I learned some major facts, because Sesame Street was on 11, 12 years before I was born. Hannah, were you a Sesame Street watcher?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I basically was in my formative years as a child when Sesame Street was probably in its heyday. Like, really, it was just getting off the ground big time.
I wasn't the biggest watcher. I just, you know, I knew of it, and I knew who the characters were, but I did not know about Roosevelt Franklin. Didn't know.
Mm-hmm,
I didn't know that, you know, the first Gordon from 69 to 72, played by Matt Robinson, invented what was supposed to be the black Muppet, Roosevelt Franklin. He said, and this blew my mind, he said, on one hand, Roosevelt talked different. He was different because in real life, inner city kids knew they were different. And on the other hand, a lot of people said Roosevelt perpetuated stereotypes and Roosevelt Franklin disappeared. And obviously, Joe Bluth, if you ever watched Arrested Development, brought Franklin, and I did not know he was based on Roosevelt Franklin. I didn't realize that Sesame Street was supposed to be filmed in, you know, an inner city street. It didn't connect with me when I was a child. I was like, I just thought it was a street. I didn't realize it was actually for, you know, a certain demographic who raised by television maybe should be watching something good. I didn't know, but I totally believe that Mississippi wouldn't air it because it was too integrated. Way to go, Mississippi. Two thumbs up there. Hannah, what did you take away from Street Gang?
Well, I took away from Street Gang that the original Gordon, the guy, was the father of Holly Robinson Pete. I had no idea that that Holly Robinson Pete's father was an actor and was in Sesame Street in the original running. But I took away, I found so much of it fascinating that I was not aware. This really focuses on the creators and how socially conscious they were how they really did. You know, I was more, you hear about Jim Henson all the time and as the Muppet creator, but to really understand the co-founder of the Sesame Workshop and the original director of Sesame Street and the family that they formed. I really, the vibe is very similar, I would say, to the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood documentary in terms of sort of really talking about the need for educational television and for not talking down to kids. But you really understood the parallels and also the differences between what the intent was with what they were doing with Sesame Street. Now there was a whole curriculum that teachers and TV writers got together and followed an educational curriculum with the programming that really was aimed at inner city kids and disadvantaged kids and giving them this extra boost of something to watch that would be valuable and to help their education while keeping them entertained. And so I just got a lot out of watching it. And, you know, it's amazing. It's I think you're going to hear a lot about Sesame Street now. I think they're in their 50th anniversary. And they're in more than 150 countries. And so I just, it really is an institution. And the fact that it has managed to evolve and survive is just pretty phenomenal. So I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I had seen, they covered the death of Mr. Hooper. And I'd seen that actually covered in documentary form before, but they didn't explain, you know, how, you know, you brought it up with the producers went out and talked to teachers and childhood development academics. And they said, you know, we want to address that Mr. Hooper died in real life. How do we do that? And said, you know, keep it above board. But the one takeaway they need to know is that death is final. You know, Big Bird's like, you know, well, where's Mr. Hooper? Oh, he's dead? Well, I'll just tell them when he comes back. And like, no, Mr. This is the one thing, it's final. He's not coming back. And you know, he says, why? And they say, because. You know, that's strong. I wrote down a quote. It was so good. One of the creators said, this is what TV would look like if it loved you, not if it was trying to sell you something. It's like, oh man, I got to write that. That's a good quote right there. So yeah, I mean, this is not the greatest documentary of the year, but it's an effective documentary. It's absorbing. It played at this year's virtual Sundance Film Festival. I don't think it won any of its documentary awards, but yeah, for even someone who didn't really watch Sesame Street but was aware of it, this works. This works. I think it really, anybody, even if everyone's familiar with Sesame Street, everyone knows who Bert and Ernie is, and it's just cathartic. It's nice. You know, you watch your Octopus Teacher and then watch Street Gang.
Yeah, well, and it's not like I've watched it in the past 40 years, Charlie. It's been a while.
Well, I wasn't assuming
you did. It's been a while since I watched it. But it's in select theaters starting April 20th, but then it will be on demand May 7th. So if you don't, you know, I don't think it's something you necessarily have to run out and watch in the theater. But when it arrives on demand, I think it's decent family-friendly viewing.
Well, all right, let's talk about TV now since we were talking about Sesame Street. Falcon, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier is done on Disney Plus. Loki's coming down the pike. So is The Bad Batch. The Bad Batch is actually starting next week on Tuesday. If you remember The Bad Batch, they had like a character, they had an arc on the final season of Star Wars, The Clone Wars, which I've seen recently because my kid's been watching it. So I'm looking forward to The Bad Batch, but that's, you know, that's not the Avengers, that's Star Wars, and it's also Star Wars cartoony, so that might not be for everybody. But The Falcon and the Winter Soldier is almost for every, my 8-year-old watched it. There's a lot of S words in there, by the way. Every time I'd look over at him, and yeah, I know he caught it. He was looking at me. But I'm the one person in America, the one person on Earth, in the globe, who didn't like this series. I loved WandaVision. Give me WandaVision all day, every day, but The Falcon and the Winter Soldier just got on my nerves. So many subplots about it just annoyed me, and I really didn't care for it. But I'm assuming you became a Falcon and Winter Soldier fan.
I did, and I actually enjoyed it more than WandaVision. It's just two very different beasts, and so I don't think you can completely compare the two series. I think some people are going to like one more than the other just based on what kind of person you are, Charlie. And I did enjoy finishing that story arc of seeing the full 6-episode arc here that really ended with a new African-American Captain America in the Anthony Mackie as the new Captain America, with Bucky, played by Sebastian Stan, as his sort of as his partner. And so you can kind of see that they've set it up for these two to be sort of that next Marvel dynamic duo, you know, not quite Batman and Robin from the DC universe, but I think they're engaging, and I liked where the story went. And considering it's like, if you're going to do that, if you're going to say, we're going to keep the Captain America character alive without sort of recasting, so to speak, then I think that Falcon and the Winter Soldier did what it set out to do. I think it could either, I think it would be hard to sustain itself as a series. So I do see it more as a setup to a Captain America 4 film, which of course has been, you know, rumored to already be in development, but nobody will actually fess up to that being the case. But I think if this was any kind of trial balloon, then I do think they will move ahead pretty darn quick with Anthony Mackie in the role.
There are two things I liked about the series. I liked that they tried to make the central problem, what do you do when half of humanity comes back? You know, that kind of makes half of humanity refugees. Nobody else knows where to go. How do you combine the haves and have-nots? They tried to make that the central dream, but they didn't. They took one vigilante, made her radicalized, and tried to stop terrorist attacks, one terrorist attack per episode. So they didn't really address the problem. They alluded to the problem, but they really didn't touch it. I also like the Isaiah Bradley character, the old black guy who had the super serum, who was thrown into prison. He had a great quote of, you know, there'll never be a black Captain America, and if there was, no self-respecting black man would ever take that job. I'm like, man, Isaiah Bradley, yeah, I'm paying attention to you, man. I hated the boat, the family boat. Come on down and help save the boat community. Don't you remember everything the Wilsons used to do for you? Come on down, help out the boat. I hated the boat. I hated fake Captain America. I hated his arc. I get that they gave it to another guy, and then he's got some PTSD, and no one can live up to Steve Rogers. He's a terrible character. He introduced a very intriguing character in Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who was in it twice, nailing both, you know, scenes. She's funny. Where is she going to go in? But I hated that guy. And it's not even just, you're not supposed to like him either, but I didn't like his arc.
No, I agree with that. If I had to sort of pull apart what I did and didn't like about it, then certainly I was never a fan of, I just didn't buy into it. It didn't make sense with the character because you sort of, but at the same time, you know, it leaves the door open for going in so many different ways. And the family arc and his boat, it was unnecessary, but again, I think they were just planting seeds for what they could do long term with the story and with the characters. And so you just have to look at it as an origin story movie in six parts
they had their origin stories. We had the Falcon's origin story. The Winter Soldier had his own film as an origin story. We're done with origin stories. Move on and do stories now. No, take the origin out and let's do stories now.
But you can't, you had to reset. You absolutely had to reset with the Falcon and Anthony Mackie in the role of Captain America. It would not work any other way. Otherwise you would just have more Falcon movies. And I think there's something inherently in the Captain America, you know, icon that makes it work for a lot of people. And I don't think Falcon ever really as a character took hold all that much. And this just provided a great reset. And so I was really pleasantly surprised. I had my doubts with episode one, but I felt much better about it come episode two. And sure enough, I do think that as it progressed, you got invested and the payoff was there to really set the stage for what comes next.
WandaVision is the most creative, most original, most fresh, most off the wall. We've never seen this thing before. Things I might have ever been on television. That's how crazy it was and why it worked for this guy. Falcon and Winter Soldier, you know, I've seen Scarecrow and Mrs. King. You know, I've seen Simon and Simon. You know, I don't. Falcon and Winter Soldier is just any other duo they put together. You know, Laverne and Shirley. I've never seen Laverne and Shirley.
Oh my god!
Or Cagney and Lacey. That's all before me. But it's just another blank and blank show. That's all it is.
No, I disagree. I think people like those. What you just named, they were all engaging pairs, and so I think you just sort of. Busted your own argument there. But I would say that WandaVision is definitely the more unique, but a lot of people wouldn't get it, especially if they weren't familiar with older sitcoms and also if they weren't familiar with the Marvel Universe. In fact, I don't think either of these series, the limited run series, whether it's WandaVision or Falcon and the Winter Soldier, you do need to be a Marvel fan. You can't just go into these blind. They're not going to make any sense to you if you don't know at least the essence of what happened in Avengers Endgame and Infinity War.
All right. That's probably a good place to stop beating that dead horse.
We will wrap it up there. Thanks so much for listening, as always. If you have a question, comment, need to vent to Charlie, or want a drink of Kraken, you can reach us at thecinemaclash.com or on Twitter. Till next time, stay safe. And if you haven't already done so, please do as Charlie just did today and take the shot or two.
Or two. Thank you.